Now, Sky News coverage of election 2016 continues. This is Viewpoint Monday with Chris Kenny.
Sydney's battered by storms and we start hearing about climate change. I kid you not, one of the issues we'll be looking at on Viewpoint tonight. Also going to show you some political ads you probably haven't seen. They're absolute rippers and they go to the heart of this campaign, why I think a lot of people are disenchanted with the major parties and are looking for those independents. Also, in just a moment, we'll be speaking live to Anthony Albanese, Albo fighting against the Greens instead of the Tories at this election campaign. Which does he reckon are the tougher opponent, I wonder? And we're also going to speak to a former chief of the Australian Army who can't for the life of him understand why this election campaign is yet to focus on crucial issues of national security, especially, of course, when we've got soldiers at this very minute risking their lives in Iraq and Syria. So all that coming up in the program. But first up, the politics of personality, the political backstory of the leaders that really came into play today in the election campaign. We don't really do a lot of this in Australian politics. We don't normally get into the personal stories and the backgrounds in detail of our politicians. It's more an American thing to do, I suppose. There's a bit of it here, but it's never been a really strong focus in Australian campaigns. We do like to know a bit about the people who are going to put themselves up to lead the country, though, and we certainly got an insight from that very deliberately from Malcolm Turnbull today. Now, he put out a video yesterday talking about being raised by his dad as a single father for most of his life, and that video then very directly, of course, drew attention to the issue. And, of course, Malcolm Turnbull was asked about this in a press conference today, and he got quite emotional and decided he would share his experience of growing up with his father after their mum left them when Malcolm was about 9 years old. Have a look at this.
When my mother left us, we had nowhere to live. And, you know, Dad rented a flat and didn't have any furniture. I think the only bit of furniture we had left was my bed. So it wasn't... It was, he had every reason to be a bit unhappy, to say the least. And yet he never, ever said a bad word about her. You think about, you know, you think about how rare that is. He never uttered a critical word of my mother in all of those years.
Now, there's some political strategy, obviously, in putting this out there, putting these issues out there, but I can tell you, as someone, as you know, who knows Malcolm Turnbull personally, that there's plausibility in what he's had to say. There's authenticity in what he's had to say. That's exactly the story that I've heard from him privately, mate to mate, if you like, man to man. That's the story of his life. But he's definitely strategically decided to put it out there in an election campaign. There can be no denying that. And a lot of people are criticising him for it. He's getting criticised from the left and the right for putting his personal story out there. I don't think Malcolm Turnbull is pretending that he was ever poor, but he is demonstrating that he has not had the life of privilege, the silver-tailed run all the way through his life. And the point that the critics need to understand here, whether they're from the left of politics or the right, as I say, is that this is inevitable, absolutely inevitable, that Malcolm Turnbull needs to share with the country these aspects of his background, because night after night, hour after hour, on our television screens and in radio ads, we are hearing the Labor Party denounce him as being out of touch. In their press conferences, in their speeches, Labor are saying Malcolm Turnbull is a rich silver tail, a mate of the bankers and millionaires, and out of touch with the Australian public. So I'm afraid if you're going to run an attack like that relentlessly, that is personal, that goes to someone's personal background, of course Malcolm's going to show his side of the story. Of course he's going to open up and tell you what he says is his personal story. Absolutely unavoidable. That's my view. And joining us now live from Melbourne is Anthony Albanese, the member for Grainler and the People's Choice as Labor leader, of course. Thanks for joining us, Albo.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Now, you've got a big fight on your hands holding your inner Sydney seat of Grainler, of course, with a strong challenge from the Greens. Is that hampering your campaigning? Here you are in Melbourne. Now you want to campaign around the country. Surely you need to spend most of your time in Grainler.
No, well, I'm concerned about a Labor government, not just about my electorate. And I've been out there fighting the Liberals each and every day. I woke up in Perth this morning. It's my second visit to Western Australia during the campaign. I've been to Queensland three times. I've been to South Australia, Tasmania, and I've been to Victoria twice. So I'm out there campaigning each and every day against the Liberals while the Greens are campaigning against me. I mean, someone's got to fight the Liberals, and it certainly isn't the Greens political party, who seem determined to concentrate on attacking Labor. And Adam Bandt was there again today on Sky News attacking me. He's got a bit of an unhealthy obsession, I think, Chris. He can't seem to do an interview without mentioning me and without talking about his candidate in Grainler, although he doesn't talk about his views that often.
We'll come to you. We'll come to the candidate in a moment.
Keep them a bit quiet.
I am pleased that you're calling your opponents the Liberals. Often you've talked about fighting the Tories. They're different beasts, surely.
Oh, no. Well, Tories are people who believe in class politics, and this current bunch of Liberals certainly do. They're certainly not smaller Liberals.
I reckon there's a lot of class warfare coming from your side of this campaign.
When a smaller Liberal takes over the Liberal Party, he becomes a voice of... I mean, I see Malcolm Turnbull, but I hear Tony Abbott, and I think that's why people are so disappointed in Malcolm Turnbull.
That's not a good strategy. You're just reassuring his Conservative flank now.
Oh, well, at the end of the day, they're going to go somewhere, and I suspect I know where they'll land.
Now, you make that strong point about how the Greens attack Labor. The Greens took a seat off Labor, of course, in Melbourne. They've got their eyes set on another Labor seat in Batman, in those inner northern suburbs of Melbourne, and, of course, your seat in the inner west of Sydney. Also, Tanya Plibersek, they'll have a go pretty hard there in Sydney. Do you think that that's a mistake? The Greens could actually win a seat off the Liberal Party? They couldn't, could they? I mean, if they want to get seats in the lower house, they have to attack Labor.
Well, of course they could. They took Paran here in Melbourne off the Liberal Party at the last Victorian state election, but they choose not to. Richard Di Natale is in danger of being in breach of the electoral laws because he spends more time in the electorate of Grainler than he does in his own seat, although I'm told that he's moved his office from Geelong, where I was today, into Melbourne. But he seems to be up there at least once a week. Adam Bandt's been up there non-stop. And it's extraordinary because they're campaigning for a bloke who... The video went up about the Greens Party. It wasn't something found by us. It was put up there by the Greens proudly, with Jim Casey saying that he'd prefer a Tony Abbott government rather than a Bill Shorten-led government, demos.
Sorry to interrupt you, Anthony Albanese, but I've got that grab, some of that grab ready to roll, so we should share that with the viewers before you make your comments on it. This is your Greens opponent, the man the Greens are putting up to run in the seat of Grainler. His name is Jim Casey, and here's what he said in that video.
I would prefer to see Tony Abbott returned as Prime Minister with a Labor movement that was growing, with an anti-war movement that was disrupting things in the streets, with a strong and vibrant women's movement, Indigenous movement, and a climate change movement that was actually starting to disrupt the production of coal.
And that's what you're referring to there, Anthony Albanese, that he actually wants... he wants people protesting in the streets rather than a stable Labor or left-of-centre government.
Well, it's an extraordinary proposition saying that he wants people to be worse off so you get better demonstrations. I want to lift people up. And what's extraordinary as well about that particular clip is he's not sitting there by himself. He's sitting there next to Adam Bandt and Lee Rhiannon, who both applaud those remarks, both applaud the idea that it is better to have an Abbott government essentially doing people over because of the demonstrations and the response to it, than it is to try and get practical outcomes. I'm in Parliament to make a positive difference to people's lives, not so that bad things happen, so you get good demos. It's an extraordinary proposition for someone who's presenting themselves in certainly the seat that's been identified by the Greens as their main objective at this election.
Well, given that you've got such an extreme candidate running against you and that the coalition are no chance to run that, win that seat, it's probably not surprising that you're getting some support from some unusual quarters in this election campaign. And, of course, famously, the Daily Telegraph newspaper, the News Corporation tabloid that markets to Western Sydney unashamedly and has been no friend of the Federal Labor Party over recent years, actually went with a front page. Here's a picture of you on screen holding that front page, Save Our Albo. Now, are the Daily Telegraph doing you a favour by coming in to bat for you, or do you reckon that's just got the green left in your electorate even more suspicious?
Well, I didn't ask them to do it, but I welcome support from any quarters. And the fact is that they know, as do people who are sensible and about positive reform, you can't have the position that the Greens have in my electorate, for example, which is to close Kingsford Smith Airport, but to oppose Badgerys Creek Airport as well. So you'd have Sydney as a global city. The actual position is to not have an airport in Sydney. It's an extraordinary proposition, and it's a matter of record that when it comes to practical policies that need to be advanced, the Greens political party, they're out there pretending during this election campaign that they make funding announcements each and every day as if they're an alternative government. I mean, Adam Bandt and this crew are delusional. They're delusional about their position when they say, hey, the Greens will spend $300 million or X dollars on renewable energy. They're 75 votes short of a majority in the House of Representatives of legislating anything at all. All the Greens can do is to protest after decisions are made. I'm in politics, and the reason why I'm campaigning, not just in my seat but around the country, to make decisions. And you make decisions in our Westminster system around the cabinet table. I'm there to make a difference, and I've done so previously in the Labor government, and I also do so by attempting to hold the government to account and put up practical suggestions. Badgerys Creek Airport, for example, could not have occurred without the government and the opposition agreeing. It had been stymied for decades, as you know, Chris. This is a real breakthrough. I give Tony Abbott Abbott's government credit for it, but I think we deserve equal credit for the fact that we've been responsible and determined to get this done in the interests of jobs and economic activity in Western Sydney.
Yeah, and you contrast that with the delusion and extreme policies of the Greens. Yet, of course, if Labor does well in this election and Adam Bandt's returned in Melbourne and maybe the Greens win Batman as well at the expense of David Feeney, you would go into coalition with the Greens to form government as sure as day follows night?
No, we wouldn't, Chris, and we've made that very, very clear. And in the past, of course, the Greens, the first people they went into government with in coalition was in Tasmania, and it was the Liberal Party. So there's no question that of what our position is. Bill Shorten's made it very clear. I've made my position clear as well. We want a majority Labor government.
Sure, and, you want that's that. Why, you want that. But are you prepared to shun the Greens and stay out of office? You were part of the Gillard government, which was based in large part on an alliance with the Greens.
I was also a part and deputy prime minister in the Rudd government, and we had no coalition with the Greens or anyone else. And at that time, When we met with the minor parties, we made it clear that Kevin had been elected leader of the Labor Party, I'd been elected deputy, we'd be going onto the parliamentary floor, and they could do whatever they want, but we weren't going to do a deal, and we didn't.
You'd rather be in opposition than form any formal agreement, strike any formal agreement with the Greens?
We will not be entering into a coalition. We will govern as the Labor Party in our own right. And I'm very hopeful as well that we will... We're aiming to win not just 76 seats. We're aiming to win more than that. I've been in WA yesterday, campaigning in Cowan and Stirling, two non-held seats. Today, I've been with Libby Coker, our candidate in Corangamite, as well as Richard Miles in Geelong, campaigning there. We're out campaigning right around the country because we believe that this country needs a Labor government. This is a government that's run out of steam in its first term. It's quite extraordinary that Malcolm Turnbull's like the dog that caught the car. He doesn't know what to do with it. He's the Prime Minister. But there's no vision, there's no plan, which is why we're having the longest election campaign in recent political history.
We're only just getting warmed up in this election campaign, Anthony Albanese. When you say
we're just getting there.
You fight hard against the Liberals, the Tories, as you call them, and the Greens. Which organisation, which political party, in your view, is a bigger threat to the country, would do more damage to the country? The Greens, who want to shut down our second largest export industry, or the Liberal Party, who want to try and generate economic growth through tax cuts?
Well, I'm concerned, Chris, that you're buying some of the rhetoric because the Greens aren't in a position to be a threat to anything. They have one member of the House of Representatives.
They could install the next government if there's a hung parliament, and certainly in the Senate they will wield enormous power.
They have one member of the House of Representatives where government is formed, the same number as the Katter Australia Party, or at this point in time, the PUP, Clive Palmer's party, and I expect that. You know, Bob Katter's probably favourite to be returned in Kennedy. And I expect that he will have one member and the Greens will have one member after the next election. This is an election that's about Labor versus Liberal. It's about Bill Shorten versus Malcolm Turnbull. It's about our vision for education and health and infrastructure and jobs versus the Liberals' vision of giving tax cuts for large corporations.
But do you believe those Liberal policies are more sensible and more pragmatic and less adverse for the nation than the policies proposed by the Greens?
Well, they have to come up with fully costed policies, as do we. That's the difference. There are two mainstream political organisations in Australia, and people should, in terms of the House of Representatives, where government is formed, that's the choice that's before people. And that means that you have to actually not just promise whatever people want to hear. You have to make choices. See, the Greens don't have to make choices. They can say, for example, 100% renewable energy. Now, well, how do you turn the lights on? You need to transition to a carbon-constrained economy. You can't do it overnight. You need to make sure that you look after the workforce, that you are practical and look after the economy. And both the major parties certainly have to do that. We have a serious policy on climate change. I don't think the Liberal Party do. The Greens have quite often good sentiments, but no practical way of achieving it. And that's just one example. We have a 50% renewable energy target by 2030. We will be able to get there. Well, we can't get there to 100% renewable energy immediately.
I think your policy is wildly ambitious, but you're right, the Greens are way out there on another limb. Let me just finish up on the Labor Party before I let you go, and I'm going to refresh your mind and that of the viewers of a very difficult time for you and Labor when Kevin Rudd was coming back to challenge Julia Gillard. You had always been a loyal supporter of Kevin Rudd's, although you were a loyal servant to Julia Gillard when she was Prime Minister. Have a look at Anthony Albanese. I think it's 2012 we're talking about here.
I have devoted... my life to advancing the cause of Labor. I have despaired in recent days as I have watched Labor's legacy in government be devalued.
Yeah, Anthony Albanese, that was obviously a difficult time, but my point here is, I mean, I've been openly... I've admired what you did then because no one could question your loyalty in these difficult circumstances. But how does it sit with you now with Bill Shorten as leader of your party? You ran against him and he defeated you because he had greater factional support in the parliament. You had a majority of the support among the Labor membership. But you showed integrity and loyalty throughout that process. Bill Shorten is the man being put up as Prime Minister. He backstabbed two Prime Ministers. He was disloyal to Kevin Rudd and then disloyal to Julia Gillard. Does that sit uneasily with you?
What sits well is the fact that we've moved on and we learnt the lessons as a political party. Of course, it's the Liberal Party that have got rid of a leader, an elected Prime Minister in his first term in Tony Abbott. What I said there, I think, was I stand by my comments. Labor in government, I believe, was a good government. I think we did devalue our currency by what occurred in 2010. I remain a good friend of both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. I admire them both. But what occurred was not in the interests of the Labor Party because it was very difficult then to go out and talk about the response we had to the global financial crisis, saving 200,000 jobs, if we deposed an elected Prime Minister. I think the Liberal Party are having the same difficulty in this campaign. If they've governed so well, why did Malcolm Turnbull knock off Tony Abbott? And that's why you have Malcolm Turnbull struggling to have a narrative, struggling to have show that leadership position and that strength because he's unable to do that, to break with Tony Abbott's legacy.
To embrace that legacy.
And I think it's causing a great deal of issues. They didn't learn the lessons. The good news is for Labor faithful that we did. And we, this term, have been very united. I've supported Bill Shorten strongly during this term. I've done my best each and every day to take up the ball for the cause of Labor, as I did in government under both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. And I think if you concentrate on your internals, as we were guilty of doing, the electorate will punish you and they'll mark you down. What you need to be doing every single day is never lose sight of the fact that we have a great privilege in serving in the federal parliament. Not many people get to do it. There's a lot of people competing to do it right now. Make every day count. Make every day count. To make a difference to their lives, to improve their lives. I mean, that's why I'm so frustrated by the actions of the Greens in my electorate, because they're not concerned about improving people's lives.
I'm going to have to cut you
off.
You've
had
a good go at the
Greens.
They've
got a candidate who says they want their lives to be worse.
He wants Tony Abbott back. He's in sync with the so-called Delcons. That's what I like about your Greens candidate.
He is indeed.
But thanks very much for joining us tonight, Anthony Albanese. Good luck in Grainlow. You better get back
great
there and knock on some
you,
doors.
Chris.
All right, thanks.
I'll be...
Anthony Albanese, the man who, as I said, actually won the Labor Party ballot to get the leadership, but Bill Shorten took it out in the end. Of course, the interesting thing, he wouldn't want to talk about this because it is hypothetical upon hypothetical, but if Bill Shorten loses this federal election in 4 weeks' time, look out for Albo, see whether he puts up his hand again to lead the Labor Party. Be back after the break to talk about national security and why it's gone missing in this election campaign. Don't forget, got a great panel coming up with Peter Beattie and Miranda Devine, going to talk about the Sydney storm and climate change, among other things. But joining me now, live from Canberra, is the former Chief of the Australian Army, Peter Lay. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Look, the reason I wanted to catch up with you, you've written some a fascinating piece about national security and the fact that it's basically absent from the election campaign so far, which is extraordinary at any time, let alone when, a time when we've got our defence personnel risking their lives in the Middle East as we speak.
That's the point, isn't it? We've got soldiers, sailors and airmen deployed in very active campaign areas supporting the efforts that the Iraqis are taking in and around Fallujah. We've got people also supporting what's happening up in Syria around Raqqa, and also potentially what's going to happen in Mosul. We're not hearing a peep, are we? As I said, we've heard more about Johnny Depp's dogs than we had about this really important issue for our people deployed there, but also what does it mean for Australia? What are we trying to achieve there? And I think we should be talking about it much more.
But there's a broader issue too when you talk about Islamist extremism, which is what we're countering in Islamic State in those countries, but also the rise of Islamist extremism again in Southeast Asia. We've had terror attacks in Indonesia again. And, of course, we've had three fatal terror attacks perpetrated by Islamist extremists in Australia. So this broader national security issue domestically, regionally and in the Middle East is absolutely palpable, surely.
Well, there's lots of things to talk about, isn't it? As you pointed out, the problem with terrorism and what are we going to do about the counter-terrorism effort, but also the problems of what's happening in the Middle East, because we've got our main forces deployed there. We've got soldiers deployed on the ground. We've got the Royal Australian Air Force doing, frankly, a terrific job in the air over Syria and supporting both the Syrians and the Iraqis. But one of the things we're not doing is fully comprehend what's going on there. And I know it's really hard. What are the objectives? Who are the players? But I've said a few times now, what's our strategy? We've got people deployed there in the Middle East. What are our ends as a nation on the ground there? What means are we deploying to try and achieve those ends? And what are the ways we're going to use the equipment that we've got? The same strategy criticism also applies to what we're doing in the long term about the radical Islamists, because it's not just the Islamic State, it's not just the Caliphate. Al-Qaeda are still there. We're seeing, as you've mentioned, what's happening here in Southeast Asia in our region, but also across the north of Africa, in Libya, what's happening in Yemen, which frankly is just terrible, but also what's happening in the north of Nigeria. There's a lot to be thought about, and I think the Australian public and our people who are deployed would like to hear more about what we're doing in the name of this government overseas.
And when you worry about the clarity of Australia's strategy and where we see Australia's role unfolding in all of this in coming years, it leads you, of course, to the global strategy and United States strategy. And I suppose that in large part that's the problem, isn't it, given that we sign up to coalitions led by the United States, and there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what the US strategy is in the long run.
Well, and I guess you're referring there to Donald Trump and what happened there. And
well,
frankly, that's a bit hard to think about.
We don't even have to think about that added level of confusion. Mm. But even on current settings, do we have a clear idea of what the United States is trying to achieve when it comes to Syria and Iraq?
I think in many ways they'd like to support the anti-IS, the anti-radical Islamist forces, so what you've got in Iraq, but supporting them will bring their own problems, and gee whiz, who to support in Syria. But I think the overriding issues for the United States, and I would think that the President of the United States is trying to achieve two things. In the Middle East, he's trying to achieve not too many more American troops on the ground. It's an economy of force effort. He would like to see the Middle East, the region, solve their own problems, and that's proving to be very hard. But probably the really key issue is to try and control the nuclear things that are going on in the Middle East. He seems to have been able to achieve something with Iran, but there are real issues about what's happening in nuclear nuclear issues, and the thought of a breakout of nuclear power in the Middle East is something that the Americans are very keen to contain. So they're the big issues. And in the meanwhile, and I've said, we're really on a set and forget strategy. Let's just try and keep what's happening in Iraq and Syria as low as possible. Well, I think our troops deserve more than a set and forget strategy.
Now, a lot of people would suggest, and in fact, I think Bill Shorten suggested this in an aside today, that the reason we don't have a debate about these national security issues is because there's a bipartisan approach, because the major parties are in agreement. Now, that's largely true, especially when it comes to the Middle East deployment, but is that good enough reason not to be having some sort of national debate about exactly what's going on and, as you say, the ultimate strategy?
No, it's no good reason at all. In fact, in some ways, I think a bipartisan approach constrains the way we think about our strategy, the way we think about our defence. So I'd like to see them talking about these things, and maybe they'll come to an agreement at the end, but in some ways it's just a recognition that they don't think defence and security are important enough, and they think they can go on with other things at the time of an election campaign. Surely this is the time to talk about it, recognise that we're at war, and for the soldiers on the ground, that's the plain truth of all of this. They're at war, and the decision now 15 years ago to go to war is remade every day, and that our troops stay there. So we need that debate every day that they're there. What are we going to achieve? How are we going to achieve it? And what is the exit strategy? At the moment, it's really hard to know what victory will look like in the Middle East on the ground.
Indeed.
But also in the longer term, what will victory look like against the radical Islamists? Because even if IS disappear, even if the caliphate disappear, that's not the end of the war on terror. They've gone to many other places. They're very flexible. They're very adaptable. Preparing places in Libya. There's escape zones all over the place. And don't forget, Al-Qaeda are still about.
Well, this
IS have stolen their thunder.
Yeah, indeed. Go on, and there are very other manifestations of it. Boko Haram, or in our own region, Jamaa Islamiyah and the like. And I suppose this is the big question that I'll try and get you to address, and that is the real need for a conversation, ongoing debate on these issues, to my mind, I'm interested to get your thoughts on it, is that there is a war against an ideology here. It's not against an army in one place or a terror cell in another country. They are united by this evil ideology, which, of course, is self-sustaining and pops up in many different guises around the world and in our own suburbs. So don't we need to be upfront in talking about it? We seem to have politicians of all stripes who don't even want to mouth the words Islamist extremism. They try to avoid that topic if at all possible.
In these sorts of times when we're at war, we need to be as direct and as blunt and accurate and factual as we can. And I think you're right, we do need this conversation, but we don't seem to be prepared to have it. And so we need to try and understand what the enemy want. And it's strange having to say words like that, but if we're at war, we're opposed to someone in the most serious of ways. Our troops have died in Afghanistan, and there's potentially danger for those that are there now. So we do need to talk about, well, what do they want? And it's very clear when you look at their ideologues, people like Syed Qutb and others, they don't want our form of government. They want to replace the forms of government broadly through the Middle East with Sharia law. And then in many ways, they have global ambitions. And I particularly am pretty happy with the way I live in this country, the form of government that we've got, and I don't want Sharia law. So we need to discuss that first. What does it mean? And then what does it mean for our friends and allies? Just look at the maelstrom and the mayhem that's going on through the Middle East. How can we help them? And how can we make sure that we remain a cohesive society, able to support countries around the world who want to help?
Well, it's important you're talking out about this, and I appreciate your time tonight. I do want to ask you on one domestic issue before I let you go, and that was the repatriation of the bodies, the remains of Vietnam veterans last week. As former Chief of Army, were you disappointed that the Prime Minister and the opposition leader weren't there to partake in that ceremony?
I was just thrilled that they brought our veterans home, that they brought the bodies home to their families. It's up to the politicians to decide whether they go or not, and I think Bill Shorten has said today he regrets not being there. It was still a very dignified arrival home, and frankly, if the election travel circus had turned out there, I don't think it would have been as dignified. So let's just be grateful that the bodies are home, the families are reunited, and we're able to say to those soldiers that died in Vietnam and Malaya, thanks for what you did. We're proud of your service.
Well said, Peter Lay. Thanks very much for joining us on Viewpoint tonight.
Thank you, Chris.
As former Chief of the Australian Army, Peter Lay, saying that we owe it to this nation to talk about the big issues of national security during an election campaign, I could not agree more. After the break, Miranda Devine and Peter Beattie. Welcome back to Viewpoint. Great panel as ever here on Viewpoint Mondays. Joining us from the Daily Telegraph, Miranda Devine. And from Queensland, we're joined by former Queensland Premier Peter Beattie. Thanks for joining us again, Peter.
Chris?
Let's kick off by getting your assessment of the campaign, how it's going for both sides just past the halfway mark.
Well, Chris, I think if you have a look at the nightly news and you follow it closely, my view is that the Labor Party campaign is slightly better organised than the Turnbull campaign. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win. I just think that they are putting up those issues, particularly the ones that are the sort of the battler issues, and the issues about education, health, bread and butter issues is a better way to describe it. So I think they're slightly ahead of the Turnbull campaign. I think that reflects itself in the poll. I think the problem with the Turnbull campaign is that while it seems to be going OK, and in a sense there's not a lot between the campaigns, he's not putting enough detail or meat on his campaign strategy about jobs and growth. In terms of the issue of the video he released about his family and personal circumstances, I think that's fine. I don't have an issue of it. I think when you elect a Prime Minister, you want to know as much as you possibly can about them personally, as well as their policies, because you're voting for the person as well as the party. And I have no problem with what Malcolm Turnbull put out about himself and his family history. And in a sense, that's actually smarter campaigning than what he's done up to this point.
All right, well, actually, since you mentioned that, before I come to you, Miranda, we'll just have a look at a little clip of that video that Malcolm Turnbull put out yesterday.
Most of my childhood I spent with my dad. He was a single father, and we lived together, two guys, you know, big brother, little brother, really, was the type of relationship. We were incredibly close. We didn't have much money. He was a hotel broker. And for most of that time, he was battling, like a lot of people are, a lot of single parents are, certainly.
There we go. I had my say about this at the start of the program, Miranda. What are your thoughts on this personalising of Malcolm Turnbull and on how his campaign's going?
Look, I think that's incredibly effective. And Malcolm Turnbull, one of his strengths is he has this fantastic personal backstory, which is completely at odds with the sort of gargoyle creature that Labor and his opponents put forward of him, that he's a silver spooner and, you know, is a multimillionaire who's out of touch. I mean, he had quite a sad childhood. His mother left him when he was about 9 years old. He was a latchdoor key. That is something that will really resonate with people. And, you know, the Australian story a few years ago really had an impact. So I think as the election campaign goes on, I'm sure we'll see a lot more of that. I think they've kept their powder dry a little bit at the beginning because they don't want to get people bored with it. People were sort of slightly familiar with the story. But, look, I think their campaign's going really well. And all he really has to do is show himself as a stable, competent leader, not a flake, and a bit of a departure from the Rudd-Gillard, Rudd and then Abbott years.
People are going to be voting in 8 days, though, when the pre-polls open. June the 14th, we get pre-polls opening. A lot of people will start voting early. The polls are 50-50, two-party preferred, a primary vote of about 40 for the coalition. That's not the sign of a campaign going well, is it? That's not enough to win a majority.
Look, Labor's primary vote is going backwards.
This is not enough either.
They're on 35.
There's a nil all draw the way things are at the moment,
not,
but that's a worry.
It's you not get, a nil all draw.
Well, you end up with a minority government,
well,
possibly.
Labor is on an unwinnable 35, so, you know, they're not even in the game at the moment. And the other thing you find increasingly, and this is what happened in the UK with the last Cameron win, which the polls all said that Miliband was going to win, is that people are now so used to polls, they're so famous, that they are gaming the polls. They are using the polls, and particularly when you have this sort of angry rump among the coalition, the Delcons, they are using the polls as a way to lodge a sort of protest vote that doesn't really count, but just annoys the leaders.
Well, we'll see. What the beneficiaries of this situation so far in the campaign have been the independents, the minor parties. They seem to be doing quite well. I'm going to have a look at some of their work in media malarkey. We'll be right back. here is a TV ad you probably wouldn't have seen because it's only running in South Australia, but this is Bob Day, the family first senator. Here's his ad hitting Labor and Liberal between the eyes.
Remember that game of football where the rules changed at quarter time, then changed again at half time, then changed again at three quarter time, and then at the end they recalculated the score? No, neither do I. But that's exactly what's happened to retirement savings policy. You're encouraged to save, and when you do, Labor and the Liberals come after your nest egg. Family First opposes changes to super. It's just a tax grab. Malcolm, Bill, get your hands off our super.
There you go, Bob Day. Peter Beattie, he's having a go at Malcolm and Bill. It's a pox on both your houses. It's a great climate for these sorts of minor parties and independents.
Well, that's right. And I think, just before I comment on that, can I make a very quick point, Chris? One of the other issues about the polls, and I don't necessarily agree with Miranda about it, but she raises an interesting point, but there's an even more interesting point, and that is that often the swings are in safe seats.
Sure.
And not only are they in safe seats, they're safe seats Labor, safe seats Liberal. So, in essence, a lot of the national polls mean nothing. Yep. It really, unless you look at research in the swinging marginal seats, then, frankly, the national polls don't mean a lot. In terms of the independents, you know, Chris, in a sense, this is what Malcolm Turnbull, I think, miscalculated on. If you thought about the strategy, what happens in an eight-week campaign? Everyone gets so bored with it and they get so cheesed off with both major parties, they then start looking for the first time at independents. And that ad by Bob Day, a bit crude, but frankly very effective. And I think, in a sense, a lot of those people who are unhappy about the superannuation changes are likely to cast a different vote in the Senate than they will in the House. And I think what you'll see is, and the Senate is made up, it'll be just as dysfunctional as it was over the last few years.
Yeah, indeed. Interesting about the point, the polls, Miranda, I'm certain you'd agree with that. It's about those tracking polls in the marginal seats, yes. And we don't have access to that information. What you do is you follow Mark Texter's Twitter or Facebook feed, and when he starts putting happy, smiley pictures of girls on push bikes up, you know that he thinks it's going all right. He's been a bit quiet, though, lately, Tex, if you're watching. And just, if you put up some pictures, we think that you're confident. I want to show you, Miranda, another ad. This is one that's running in New South Wales online, at least. A little clip of David Lionhelm's ad, a similar theme, pox on both the houses.
On behalf of my fellow legislators, past and present, I apologise for the laws and policies of successive coalition and Labor governments that have inflicted a profound loss of wealth on its citizens and deprived them of their liberties.
There you go, a similar theme there, Miranda. But do you think that, you know, even though we've got the double dissolution and the changes to the upper house because of the climate here, some of these faces that we thought might disappear, accidental senators, are actually going to stick around for another term?
I think they've got a good chance of doing so. And, of course, Nick Xenophon, we haven't talked about, who's as good as a Green. I mean, Bob Day and David Lionhelm are fairly sensible and they voted alongside the coalition in most things, but and will continue to do so. But you just have this wild card of the Xenophon party, and he's more aligned to the Greens. But the difference is that Nick Xenophon votes in his own interest and he is someone who is able to be negotiated with. Which I don't think you could say that about the sort of Clive Palmer rabble that we had in the last Senate.
But Nick Xenophon's going to have other senators there under his name, so he's going to have to control them, and he's had a history of not being able to do that in state parliament previously, so you do have all that unravelling.
It'll be a wild card for sure, but I mean, it was unworkable before.
Oh, yeah, look,
you had to hit the reset button, I think, and see what happens.
We do indeed. We do indeed. It's going to be fascinating to watch. Look, I just want to have a look at something else slightly off-centre today. Nothing to do with the election campaign, actually. More to do with Sydney Storms on online outrage. Now, I've got to get the thoughts from Peter and Miranda on these. I'll put some tweets up on screen now here. First up, you'll see the storms in Sydney were actually quite spectacular. You'll see... That's the wrong tweet, obviously. There's Save Our Albo. And if we come up next, you'll see the pictures of the storms battering Sydney today, a massive storm from an East Coast low. And it wasn't long before we had people on Twitter actually attacking people politically because of what was happening in the storm. I have no sympathy for the Sydney millionaires who have lost their beachfront properties, said one person. And then pretty soon it even got into the politics of it, where they're saying it's these people who voted against climate change who were to blame. But the problem here, Miranda, is these later pictures were a storm damage along Sydney beaches in 1974, in 1940, in 1950. I mean, you can't blame it on climate change, surely.
Yeah, we've never had an autumn storm in Sydney ever before, only last year and the year before. I mean, it's just this opportunistic attitude of the Greenies that they always try and seize on any climate event, any weather event, and or bushfire, and turn it into their something to promote their cause.
It is always the case. Peter, are you worried about how this debate becomes so silly like that?
Well, it does become silly, Chris. I mean, the truth is climate change in the long run will produce more extreme weather events. There's no doubt about that. But to actually identify the ones in Sydney, bearing in mind the history, is a nonsense. And that's one of the reasons why these arguments, they actually lack credibility. Climate change, as we know, does take a long period of time. It's a little bit like evolution. It doesn't happen in 50 seconds. So to people, and I was in Sydney in the weekend and it was a terrible weekend, but the truth of the matter is climate change does have radical implications, but it's a long-term strategy and you can't associate every dramatic weather event with climate change.
I mean, that's my point about it. It's just so it seems seemingly impossible to have sensible discussions about policy options and what you should be doing when it's when you've got this extreme alarmism versus other people who are saying nothing can be happening. The sensible discussion in the middle is drowned out.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And that's one of the problems. And that's one of the reasons, Chris, why I think you're getting more and more people who are saying, as you said, a pox on both houses. In these debates, people get sick of it. And I'll make this prediction to you. We've got, just under 4 weeks to go. The longer this campaign goes on, the sicker people will become with the major political parties. And they may well find an increasing vote for independence in the lower house as well as in the Senate.
Even more. Well, thanks very much, Peter Beattie, for those insights. We are right out of time, sorry. Miranda Devine, thanks for joining us again. But Peter Beattie saying, look out, those independents and others are going even higher. See you Friday night.